You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Lord, thank you for your goodness. Thank you that we are all pilgrims on a journey. We are walking with you, following in your footsteps. Lord, as we follow in the Apostles Paul's footsteps in our imaginations and for some of us with our feet, Lord, would you strengthen us? Give us clarity of vision, hope for the future. We ask this in Christ's name. Amen. The Apostle Paul is easily the most important man in the history of the church after Jesus Christ, of course. I mean, he leaves his clear stamp on Christianity, so that although the core is never quite the same, the faith itself is just there. I mean, he shapes so much of there for us in the Christian church, our story. I mean, it forever, the Christian church bears a Pauline stamp, so to speak. And since this is so, and since nearly half of the New Testament documents bear his name, I think we need to make a few introductory comments for those of us who are going on this journey in January, but for those of you today, come along with me. A few things to say about the life of Paul. It can be divided into three simple parts. First, before his conversion, a couple things to note there, that he was a Hellenistic Jew. And I think we have to take both of those things seriously. He was a Jew. He was thoroughly Jewish in his thinking. By his own testimonies in Philippians, he said, "I am a Hebrew of Hebrews, a Pharisee." By Luke's recorded testimony of him in Acts 22, he's trained under Gamaliel. Gamaliel was one of the great teachers of his day. We even know him outside of the New Testament. And he was trained under this great teacher. And he was a Pharisee. Just to maybe clear up a few things, sometimes people imagine Pharisees, maybe it comes from our Sunday school teaching, who knows where it comes from, but a lot of people kind of, I think, envision Pharisees as sort of logic, legal chopping zealots, you know, that it's all about just keeping the law and being legalistic. They were zealous for the law, to be true, and they cared about that. But they were primarily a lay movement. They flourished in the first century outside of Jerusalem. They weren't part of the establishment. They weren't there sort of nestled in the temple hierarchy, as were, let's say, the Sadducees. They were a lay movement of preachers, but they were zealous for the law. But what that meant in the first century, if you're zealous for the law, is that you want Israel to be holy place. You want it to be governed by God. And the fact that the Romans were there meant keeping the law and being zealous for the law meant you wanted the Romans out of Israel. I mean, that my point is that politics and religion weren't separated at all. They were a piece in the first century. And a person like Paul would have been political in that sense. He was zealous for the law. He was well-trained. But he was also, besides being zealous for Israel, would have known his Hebrew and Greek Bible very well as a Hellenistic Jew. And the word Hellenist just means he was Greek. He was born and raised in Tarsus, which was, if you can think of the Mediterranean, Tarsus would have been in this corner right here. That northeast corner all along the Mediterranean, a very urbane city, a lot of educated people. It was a Roman city, kind of at a major overland trade route, kind of entry place. It was an important city, and Paul would have picked up Greek fluently. He would have known that. He would have picked up something about Greek culture and Greek philosophy, certainly there. He also, his parents at some point, probably earned Roman citizenship, to which they probably passed along to him. So he was a Greek, and he was a Roman citizen, which gave a lot of advantage to people as they traveled throughout the Roman Empire. But my point is that he understood the Gentile world, the non-Jewish world, just as well as he understood Israel's story and Israel's history. Besides all that, he was likely a rabbi. In any case, he was a brilliant genius. I mean, I think the world would have heard of Saul of Tarsus had it never heard of the Apostle Paul. He was a religious zealot. Before his conversion, as I said, he had one great conviction about Jesus Christ. Because Jesus died by crucifixion, he believed that God had cursed him, according to the law. At his conversion, something massive happened, of course. On the road to Damascus, as a zealous Jew pursuing zealous keeping of the law, he was on his way to Damascus in Syria to there deal with Jewish Christians who were spreading these false rumors about Jesus, this sort of northern Galilean bumpkin, who they were calling the Anointed One, the Christ. And he was radically against this. And he was on his way to Damascus. And what happens to him? On the way to Damascus, as he's coming in, he meets the risen Christ. And for Paul, he is very clear about the fact that he met Jesus. He didn't have a vision of Jesus. He didn't have a dream of Jesus. He met the risen Lord. And Jesus confronted him. I don't think he was on his way to Damascus going, "Boy, I'm a sinner. I really need help. Something's wrong. What could make me right? Maybe, you know, as the sinner that I am, the broken person that I am, I hope I will meet Jesus." I mean, no, he was like convinced that he was doing the right thing. And Jesus met him in that moment. I mean, it blinded his eyes, walked stumbling into Damascus, and then it took Jesus in a dream to someone else to have them being bold enough to go to this fellow who had been persecuting Christians, to go to him and have him have his eyes open, so to speak. This experience on the Damascus Road had a tremendous impact on Paul's thinking. Tremendous impact. I mean, he is one of the finest and most dynamic Pharisaic minds of his day, with one of the most zealous Pharisaic hearts. I mean, when he is converted, he will be the ideal apostle to the Gentiles. And you might also just see God's humor in that too. Paul will grasp better than almost anyone else the significance of what has happened in the death and resurrection of Jesus. I mean, this just massively changed things for Paul. Indeed, his basic theology, even if it comes from his Jewish roots, his essential Christian theology comes directly from his experience of Jesus on the Damascus Road. And two basic theological things stem from that. One, the centrality of the resurrection. For him, as I said, a resurrection appearance, a resurrection commissioning. It's not a vision. And of course, with that is a new understanding of the cross. An understanding that the cross was a curse upon mankind, a judgment. But he then had to reinterpret that when he meets the risen Jesus, that it's God's no, not on Jesus, but on those who rejected him. And so he has a new understanding of Jesus that he has to process. God said yes to humankind's no. And this is why he can call Jesus his Lord. I mean, I don't think Paul unpacked all of that quickly. I think it took years for him to fully understand what this meant. There's some speculation that a good Pharisee on his way to a place like Damascus, what would he be doing as he's traveling? Was he just talking about the weather with his fellow companions? Was he just grumbling about how long and dusty it was? Well, one speculation was that, and a good Pharisee would have done this, is that they would have reflected on the throne chariot of God. From Ezekiel's vision, you know, that they would have been meditating on that, and that they would have been thinking and meditating on the King of Kings who sits on this chariot. But as he's going and meditating on this throne chariot, as he gets up and he looks maybe in the face of that one, the face he sees is Jesus. Jesus, the Lord. So massively reorientated his understanding. Is everything about his thinking, his theology had to change from that resurrection appearance of Jesus and reinterpreting what the cross is and what the cross means for him. That's first basic thing that stems from that. Secondly, a theology of grace. I mean, Pharisees, by the way, believed in God's grace. They did. They believed in God's grace. But he had to rethink what it meant that God calls the unworthy. That God calls someone like him who is persecuting Jesus and his body, his people. That God meets him. I mean, you have to just... I mean, this would have blown his categories, right? I mean, just completely. That God meets him, unworthy as he was, to be called into this ministry. I mean, it just blew him away. God accepts him freely, even though he was his enemy. And he learned and had to grow into and be transformed by that power of grace and came to realize that it meant the end of a righteousness that is based on law. And that, of course, opened the way for his ministry to the Gentiles. Just briefly, a chronology up to some of the early letters. Likely, if we can date these things with any accuracy, his conversion on the road to Damascus and then a ministry that followed that in Arabia and Syria, somewhere around 31 to 44 AD. Immediately, he goes into Damascus, where Luke says at once began to preach that Jesus is the Son of God in Acts chapter 9. But by Paul's own testimony, in Galatians chapter 1, it says he went immediately into Arabia and then later returned to Damascus. Arabia likely meant something like Mount Sinai. We don't know exactly for how long, but Galatians, Paul says in Galatians chapter 1 that this whole Damascus, Arabia, Damascus return was 3 years. 3 years. I mean, that also blows me away. That if he meets the risen Jesus, he doesn't just sort of immediately go, okay, well, I'm going to go tour the Mediterranean. I mean, he's got to rethink everything about himself. And he goes into the desert to do it. I find that interesting. In the tradition that I grew up in, they often sent out young men, mostly men, some women, after they'd had a profound conversion experience and sent them off into ministry immediately in their 20s. And inevitably, many of them, within a few years, were just burned out on ministry. I think one of the benefits of, I think, the Episcopal discerning process, even though sometimes we're quite annoyed going through it, how long it takes, this is a good thing. Think it through. Live into it. Lean into it, as Paul did. Anyways, probably Luke leaves out this Arabian experience, as he often does. Luke will often telescope events that are longer into a brief statement or two. But in any case, Paul returns to Damascus, probably for nurture among those who had been converts longer than him. But then he has to leave the city by stealth because the rulers want to get rid of him. And he has to kind of go out of the city in a basket and be let down. This is not a noble way to leave a city. Right? You have to kind of keep that in mind. So here, Paul's being shaped by the cross and by humiliation early on in his ministry. But then from Damascus, he goes to Jerusalem for a very brief stay for about 2 weeks. This is his first visit to Jerusalem as a believer, about 3 years or so after his conversion. And then after that, he goes to Tarsus. And here we're just at a complete loss for chronology. What happens after he leaves Jerusalem? He goes back home to Tarsus, but somewhere around AD 43, 44, maybe, he appears in Antioch. And then probably around 45 to 47 AD, he takes his first missionary journey, his first journey into the Mediterranean world to be an apostle along with Barnabas, sent out from the church in Antioch to be a missionary, to share this good news of grace with those who are non-Jews. Although we say that, but almost every place that he went, if he could, he started off in a synagogue. If there was a synagogue in that city, he usually started there and then preached and taught there, because he was a visiting Pharisee scholar. You know, they're great. We got a visiting teacher here. But he usually would stay in a synagogue until he got kicked out. Right? And sometimes it could be quite nasty, him being kicked out. But he goes on this first missionary journey to Cyprus, to southern Galatia, another Antioch, not the same one in Syria, but Antioch, Galatia, Iconium, Lystra, Derbe. He goes on this first missionary journey. Then, about 47, 48 AD, he goes to Jerusalem again for the council, the great council that's recorded in Acts chapter 15. And then around 50 to 52, he goes on a second missionary journey. And here, he goes a little bit further afield. This time, he goes to Troas, which is, again, it's a little map, but and I'll show you in a bit. But Troas, the ancient city of Troy, somewhere there, right on the Aegean Sea. He goes to Troas, and they get there, and then he has that great dream in the night, the Macedonian call, moves into what is known as Europe by that time. And he goes to Philippi, then Thessalonica, or Thessaloniki, Berea, Athens, Corinth. And while in Corinth, he writes his first two letters, 1 and 2 Thessalonians. Just briefly about letters. I've said this before, and most of you know this already, but Paul's letters in the New Testament, the arrangement of the canon, are just from largest to smallest, right? They're not from most important to least important. They're just from largest to smallest. But the earliest one that was written was 1 and 2 Thessalonians. That correspondence is the earliest. Those are the earliest documents that we have in our New Testament as well, arranged from largest to smallest in our New Testament. But he does something profound with letters. Most of the letters in the first century world would have resembled, in terms of length, Philemon, the shortest one of all Paul's letters. But if you're only reading letters of Paul, you think, oh, that's the short one. No, that was the normal size one. All the other ones were the sort of outliers. Romans in particular. I mean, these are long letters, and that is something profoundly different than anyone had ever done with letter writing at the time. He uses them as a theological vehicle for his thinking. They usually have a form that resembles what everyone else knew of forms, but he does something bigger and different with them theologically. They usually have a three-part salutation where the writer lets themselves be known, and if anyone is accompanying him or helping to write the letter, the beginning, the writer, the addressees, and then the greeting. Then there would usually be a thanksgiving and a prayer report, followed by the body of the letter, and then some closing matters with greetings, peace, farewells. But Paul Christianizes all of these elements. But in terms of their character, the letters, they reflect an active, sometimes impetuous mind. At times, ideas just tumble over themselves, trying to find expression. If you've ever read Ephesians chapter 1, the prayer and thanksgiving, the praise report that opens up that letter is one sentence in Greek, but covers verses 3 to 14 in English in Ephesians chapter 1. I mean, this guy just, once he gets going on a roll with certain things, especially when it comes to praising God and the great things that God has done, I mean, he just kind of, it keeps flowing for him. It's stunning, really. But there's no real consistency, precision. That's just not really Paul's thing, which I can appreciate. He's not a systematic theologian. Rather, he's a task theologian. He's writing to real people, most of whom he knows well. Anyways, he's got to Corinth, and he spends 18 months in this city, one of the longest stays, along with Ephesus, that he makes. He founds a church. And then things sort of go awry. Here I'm going to turn off the lights just so you can see a little bit better. So he goes to Corinth, and Corinth is located right on this kind of neck of land that connects Greece in the north to the Peloponnese in the south. All right, it's kind of on this narrow bit of land. Now, I have visited Corinth often in my imagination over the years. I have read books, I have looked at maps, I've looked at pictures. But I'm looking forward to seeing it and walking it in person come this January. And for today, though, I want to just offer a bit of a virtual tour of Corinth, in part to offer a test case to compare, come January, whether my imagination actually matches the image. For Paul, he, as I said, spent considerable time here, the start anyways, 18 months. He founded the house churches. And from to that church, with its multiple house churches, he sent at least four letters, two of which we have in our New Testament. Our 1 Corinthians is actually 2 Corinthians. He makes reference to my previous letter in that letter. So that's 2 Corinthians is really 1 Corinthians for us. And then there's another letter, which we don't have. But then 4 Corinthians is actually our 2 Corinthians. There you go. Fun for the whole family. He writes, and he has to write to this church who he loves because they cause problems. And he loves them. But it represents such a significant amount of what we have in our New Testament. But anyways, I want to illustrate it just quickly here this morning. Something about the social, political, economic, even geographic situations of places that Paul wrote to. And in particular, Corinth, this place. So we get to know a little bit about the city. And as I said, for those of us who are going to travel to Greece in January, we'll see whether this is at all accurate. The first place, I think, if we could go, I don't know if we're going to do it, but the Acro-Corinth. So that's looking south. So that's looking south. There's this massive stone. They used to build fortresses up there, the Acro-Corinth. If I could start anywhere on the tour of Corinth, I would start here. Most of us are familiar with the phrase location, location, location. This applied significantly to Corinth. I think if we get up to the top of that sort of mountain overlooking Corinth, it would just give us views sort of all the way around of things. We would be able to look north and south, and we could see, back to this one, we could see its position. And what it meant positionally, the location of Corinth was significant because it was right on that land bridge connecting the north and south. So there would have been all kinds of trade going that way. And for those who were trading east to west, particularly bringing things to Rome, often instead of sailing all the way around, that they would come to the port in Kenkre and they would either unload the vessel and then load it back up in another ship, or they sometimes, it would even smaller vessels, would roll them across that short little neck of a few miles. So these two cities, they're important in trade. Corinth in 146 BC was sacked by the Romans. It was completely obliterated as a city. And for about 100 years, it sort of lay dormant. But with a location like that, you can't stay dormant for very long because it was ideal for trade, for money. And by the time that Paul arrives, it was refounded in 44 BC by Julius Caesar. And by the time, about 100 years later, that Paul arrives, this city had picked itself up and had become the third leading city in the empire. I mean, lots of new money. Full of trade, full of people, ethnic diversity, wealth, and excesses of every kind. Now, if we would come down the mountain, so to speak, and that mountain which would give us sort of these views, north, south, east, west, and kind of see, Corinth is key. We would come down, and here, this is something called the Lechion Road. Now, that's kind of the main road coming into the city. Come down the hill, you'd have entered along this road. This was, in its day, in the first century, it was a broad road. It was glistening. It was white surfaced with marble, bracketed on both sides with colonnades where businesses of all sorts would ply their trade as you walk along this. Now, again, you have to use your imagination, of course, but this would have been just solid marble road walking into the city. That's posh. Do any of you have marble in your toilets? Imagine doing that, a whole road of that. I mean, this cost a bomb. This new city, though, nothing was too expensive for it. I mean, there were all kinds of building going on. active place, very, very different from Athens, which was about 50 miles to the east. I mean, the currency in Athens at that time was philosophy and ideas. But in Corinth, the currency was cold, hard cash. It was a rich city. And then we would might further explore, maybe into the marketplace if we could. And here we'd have to look below the surface a little bit more to find maybe a section of pavement that apparently is there in the ancient city's main theater. Again, a prominent position where people would read this description, which I think I put in your notes. Erastus, in return for his aedileship, laid the pavement at his own expense. A couple things. An aedile was an elected public official. In this case, it's a wealthy, upward mobile freedman. Somebody who used to be a slave was there. That's a slave name, Erastus. And some people actually believe that this is the Erastus that is written about in Romans chapter 16, where Paul writes, Gaius, because he's writing to the church in Rome from Corinth or Cenchreae, he says, I and the whole church here, Corinth, sends you greetings. And Erastus, who is the city's director of public works, send greetings. Kind of cool. He's upwardly mobile. Another inscription that would take a little bit more digging, but we'd find it on top of a monument in the marketplace. Another prominent place there in the first century was on a circle of a Corinthian column set on a stone pedestal that read, Gnaeus Babius Philinus, aedile in pontifex, had this monument erected at his own expense, and he approved it in his official capacity as duvir. Babius, that's another ex-slave name. And he rose to prominence financially and socially to reach several elected positions. He was an aedile like Erastus, but he's also duvir, the senior executive official on the city council. But these two inscriptions tell us in the first century Corinth was that there was social fluidity. I mean, you could be upwardly mobile, even as a slave who gets their freedom. And that it was a city where status mattered, and if you wanted to get anywhere, you did self-promotion. What would be the equivalent today of putting in an inscription so that everybody could read it and know about you? Do we have it? I don't know. Maybe we have ways that we self-promote things today? Are there any? I mean, all of you, I've been on your X and TikTok and Instagram accounts, and I can see that. No idea. I'm not in any of those things. But apparently, you can use these things to tell people about how good you're doing. You can maybe even show pictures about your latest hair implants that you got in Turkey or something like that. I mean, self-promotion, right? This is how you did it in the ancient world. In Corinth, they were all about self-promotion. This is a picture of strength. And I mean, this is a city of winners. Now, another place that if we could see it, this has been moved into a museum, I'm not sure if we'll see this, is a mosaic. And on this mosaic, it's a stunning one that was discovered in 1933 in the South Stoa, these complex of buildings just in the southern part of the marketplace. But it depicts two figures. First, a very muscle-bound man who's naked, except for a victor's laurel on his head and a palm branch in his hand. And then he's seated. And seated next to him is a woman who's also half naked, pouring water into a basin and holding up a shield on which it is written the word Utica. 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 You've maybe heard of Eutychus. Have you heard of that fellow? His name, it's a slave name, but it literally means lucky. Utica, which is what was on the shield, meant lucky. I mean, it's picturing an athlete because they had these great games that were held in Corinth every off year to kind of coincide with the Olympic Games. They were called the Isthmian Games. And these games were great athletic competitions. And this guy is clearly one of the winners. I mean, he's buff, he's strong, and he's showing to everybody he was a winner. He's wearing the winner's laurel wreath in these games, these pan-Hellenic festivals, almost rivaling the Olympic Games. But it represents strength and power. It points to the importance of winning. It highlights status by athletic prowess. Athletic success was a path to victory, to wealth, to honor for the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. Right? Athletic, Right? Of course, there's none of that in Alabama. You really don't care about your athletics here. But in the ancient world, they did. And they could sell things. You could get wealthy if you were successful. And then the final stop that we would make would be to the Bima. The Bima. Here, again, not so much to look at here, but the final stop on the visual tour would return us to the marketplace. Today, not much of a thing of beauty, but when Paul visited, it would have been faced with the finest blue and white marble topped with eight pillars supporting a grand roof. And while many connect that as a place of judgment, for in Acts 18, Paul is facing the Roman proconsul Gallio right at this place, this was also a place where speakers would stand to address the gathered crowds at the marketplace. In this place, at that time, the focus of the speakers was on rhetoric, the art of persuasive argument in speech or writing. But uniquely, in Corinth, in the first century, the priority of place was on decorative or sophistic speech. What I'm saying is form over content mattered when they were speaking and people were preaching and teaching from this place. A speaker's appearance, their clothing, even their build mattered alongside of whatever florid words were coming from their mouth. But again, this was a way to become quite wealthy in the first century world, in Corinth in particular. So what does this all mean for ancient Corinth? What's the story that's being communicated there? I mean, it communicated a story of success. How a city emerged from nothing to become an economic powerhouse in the empire. It communicated a story of success, of people rising up the social ranks from obscurity to positions of power and influence through their own self-promotion, through their own boasting. It communicated a story of success, of athletes competing and winning, who then became models of power and prestige that young people might even aspire to. It communicated a story of success, of orators vying for influence and applause, not based on what they said, but how they said it and what they looked like. Although this is a story that has similar lines to stories in other cities, the difference for the story of first century Corinth is one of degree. It tells of a city where social mobility was more pronounced, where status and the anxiety that goes with it was more pronounced, where self-promotion was more prevalent because recognition and reputation mattered more, and where social competition was fiercer. If you know that about Corinth, go back and read 1 and 2 Corinthians. More than any other correspondence of Paul tells stories of himself. And the stories that he tells about himself in this kind of context, in a church where people are actually beginning to second guess whether Paul was really the great apostle that we thought he was. And they're challenging his apostleship. They're saying things like, he didn't look like much. He wasn't a very good speaker. He doesn't do very well with self-promotion when this was expected. He didn't even take patronage from the Corinthians, which most people did. Instead, Paul says what? Paul tells stories like this, and just two before we close. So with that in mind, that visual tour in mind, imagine hearing this from Paul. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, the intelligence of the intelligent. I will frustrate. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. A stumbling block to Jews, foolishness to the Gentiles, but to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. 2 Corinthians has at least four lengthy passages that Paul exalts and boasts about his weakness, about his struggles, about his pain. because he wants his life to follow the pattern. And it reflects the pattern of the cross and the hope of the resurrection. Read those stories, knowing what you know and can see, even with your mind's eye, about Corinth. And then maybe even take a step back and say, and how does that relate to today? I know that there can be a temptation. If you are a minister in a very wealthy town, there could be a temptation to try to pretend to be wealthy too. I know this, that if you were in a university town, like, I don't know, Durham, England, there's a temptation for ministers there to come off being quite clever, because people are very clever. If you're in a farming community, the temptation is to reflect, you can muck it up with the farmers if you need to. You can talk tractors and combines if you need to. There's a temptation to be something you're not, is what my point is. But Paul, in the face of all of this, exalts in who he is and who he is called to be and who he follows, a crucified Jesus and resurrected, which means that he can have and delight in both his sufferings and the hope that awaits him, the hope that shapes his future. And frankly, if that doesn't shape our present now, if that future hope of resurrection doesn't influence the way that we are living, the way that we're speaking, the question is, are we reflecting the gospel? That is the hope. Even in the midst of suffering and celebration, suffering and joy, together commingled, because we follow a crucified Jesus who is also ascended, resurrected in glory, gives steel to Paul as he travels around the ancient world and as he dealt with a little bit of a disruptive congregation in Corinth. Bless you, friends. Looking forward to traveling to Greece with some of you in January. Next week, Professor Wallace and then Gil Cracky, bring it at home. All right. God bless. Have a good day.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.